Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
All right, here we go. Quiet! Quiet! Problem!
You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it, pull it down.
Mr. Allen, this may come as a shock to you, but there are some men who don't end every sentence with a proposition.
All right, I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
I don't like that music anymore. Mind if I close the window?
Every one of you listening to my voice, tell the world, watch the skies everywhere. Keep looking. Keep watching the skies.
Well, here's another nice mess you've gotten me into.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire. Many, many thanks to Michelle for the past 2 hours, but now it's time for Bums on Seats, an adrenaline rush of pure cinema. My name is Toby Miller, and there's a few of us in the studio today on this terribly hot day, joined by Bridget Bradshaw, coming up from London.
Hello.
Mark Livesich.
Good afternoon.
And Lauren McKeel for your second show?
Yes, second show today.
Okay, all right. We have a rich mix. So three reviewers in the studio, myself, and we have a rich mix of new releases to discuss over the next hour. Sandra Bullock and Kate Blanchett join forces to pick pockets in the shiny shenanigans of Ocean's 8. Rupert Everett writes, directs, and stars in The Happy Prince, a melancholic look at the last few years of the life of Oscar Wilde. Leave No Trace marks the long-awaited return of director Deborah Cranick, 8 years after she made the excellent Winter's Bone. And we've two different approaches to revenge, with a grief-stricken German thriller In the Fade and the ballistic ferocity of Sicario 2. So all that to come, but we begin the show with a bunch of slip giblets and abstractionists.
My party, my rules.
We would like to present you all with a hypothetical situation.
How hypothetical?
Not very, unless we screw up.
It's called the Tucson.
It's over 6 pounds of diamonds.
Valued at over $100 million.
$150 million, actually.
And we are going to rob it.
Sweet. One, respect. Better watch every word on your lips.
Great to see you. You look...
recently incarcerated?
That was spectacular. Two,
don't get it. These are all Russians.
They're hackers.
Are there no hackers who aren't Russian?
No, there's barely any Russians who aren't hackers. And number
four, stop. How long would it take you to make 7 pieces of jewelry?
5 or 6 hours.
How long if I told you you didn't have to live with your mother anymore?
Less.
5, all eyes.
Can anyone really be overqualified? This is the Met Gala after...
Gala, the Met Gala.
The Gala, yeah.
Police coming.
Ready to go.
Game on.
A sort of sideways sequel to George Clooney's Ocean's 11 franchise, the all-star, all-female criminal gang of Ocean's 8 promises a dose of easygoing fun in a summer that has so far seen all the dinosaurs escape and all the superheroes die. Sandra Bullock stars as Debbie Ocean, sister to George Clooney's con artist, and just as enraptured by stealing her way into the high life. She has a plan to steal a $150 million Cartier necklace. For the ambitious heist to work, she teams up with her usual partner in crime, played by Kate Blanchett, and they wrangle up a tip-top crew, including Helena Bonham Carter's desperate dress designer, Mindy Kaling's jewellery expert, and a computer hacker, played by Rihanna. Together, they plan to infiltrate, befuddle, and then rob the glitterati chaos of the Met Gala. Gala. Made the same mistake as Sarah Paulson. Laura, can begin. The original Ocean's 11 film, the George Clooney films, those three films that he made with Steven Soderbergh, they nothing more on their mind than watching good-looking people wearing expensive suits and making their plan work. Does Ocean's 8 succeed on that front?
Well, I think the filmmakers should have known what no doubt the main character does, and that's whenever you try to pass off a carbon copy as the original, it's nothing but a counterfeit. I think so many aspects of this film have been very literally lifted from the Soderbergh movies. Without any real understanding of why they were there in the first place, the convoluted nonsense of a heist plot has to be balanced out by our strong connection to well-developed, or at least moderately engaging characters, so that whenever something ridiculous happens to our character, our main character's benefit, we're not rolling our eyes in embarrassment, but cheering on our hero's good fortune. I think the only two performances in the whole film I kind of liked were Mindy Kaling and Helen Bonham Carter. They seemed to be the only two characters given anything to do that were allowed to play with their characters. And despite the fact that they have like the dumbest side mission in the film and the weird kind of Mission Impossible type
They're the only characters with a side mission, interesting. As you say, they're the only characters, yeah. They're the only two gang members who are allowed, whose mission allows them to bounce off characters who aren't gang members.
Yeah.
So they have somebody to act against, and I think that benefits both Helena Bonham Carter and Sarah Paulson.
Yeah, and I think they try to do, like, with Sandra Bullock and Cate Blanchett, have some banter there, but they're kind of already friends within the film, so it's nice to see Helena Bonham Carter and Mindy Kaling kind of get to know each other while they're, like, pulling this ruse. And despite that being the stupidest part of the film, it's the best bit because they have really good comedic chemistry.
It's Bridget, how did you find it?
I did think I would be a lot more enthusiastic coming out of it about wanting to do heists and wear awesome clothes, but it didn't really excite me in that way.
Is it because the heist is unbelievable? I know all movie heists are unbelievable, but does this one click? Does it work? Because one problem's been pointed out in other reviews, and the problem I found is that nothing really gets in their way. Nothing really stops them, and they sort of have an easy time of it. That's partly because they're brilliant at it, but at the same time, there's no real flies in the ointment.
There's a moment where I was watching the film, and I was like, oh, something should happen to, like, get in their way. And then right at that moment, you discover that the necklace, of course, a bunch of con artists have to steal a big, fancy necklace. So they come up with an obstacle of the fact that the necklace they're trying to steal has a magnetic lock at the back. I'm like, okay, here's a plot point that they need to overcome. Literally one scene later, they solve it, and they
move
on.
With the addition of a new character we haven't been previously introduced to. You might as well introduce magic suddenly into the film.
It's just like they knew they had to put something in there for conflict, but it just ends up being something to pad out the film for just a couple minutes.
Mark, one thing that I felt watching this is I wondered if it was slightly miscast, that everybody's lovely, charismatic, and fun to watch, but they don't allow Sandra Bullock to be funny. She's not a funny character, and she can do straight drama, obviously, but she's very, very good light comedian, and this is a sort of genre that benefits from that, and she just is not grumpy, but she's serious all the way through, and Cate Blanchett gets the sort of slightly lighter role.
You see, I would throw that the other way around, because we're suggesting to say she's miscast that somebody else would be better for that role. They need a better role for Sandra Bullock. That is the problem. And I would say this of Cate Blanchett and probably two or three of the other women as well, that there is no character for them to play. They're just not written on the page at all.
Is that possibly because... Because if we look at the Soderbergh films, and we have to point out this isn't directed by Steven Soderbergh, it's directed by Gary Ross, in a sort of Soderbergh Diet Coke way. Is it because Clooney and Brad Pitt, and Cate Blanchett's playing the Brad Pitt character, they're not characters in those films. We're just watching Brad Pitt and George Clooney and Matt Damon all be friends together, and that's part of the genre. Are they just tracing over those characters to give us Sandra Bullock, to give us Debbie Ocean, to give us Lou, to give us these other characters? They've made no effort to make them women, even. They're just...
Yeah, it's less a tracing and more of a vague brass rubbing. It's just as if they've got a bit of paper, just vaguely taken the barest imprint they could and assumed that would be enough. And if you look across the original 11 that were in the Ocean's 11, you know, they may just have a vague quirk. You've got the Scott Carlin and Casey Affleck who just have banter as their quirk. You've got Brad Pitt who generally walks into a scene and is eating something. That's his quirk. But at least they have a quirk. That is more, ultimately, than these women seem to have been deigned suitable to have. There is nothing about them. You could have someone wandering off the street with no acting ability, and they would have as much to work with as these women do, and it just felt as if it was sort of good enough in terms of the filmmaking, and everyone went, right, okay, next, move on. And everyone in this should have held it to a better standard.
I think with the exception of Helena Bonham Carter, who's desperate dress designer, at least has some form of motivation. Everybody else is just, again, just... Which might be why she has one or two of the best scenes in the film.
Yes, and there is at least one person having fun, and that is Anne Hathaway. Anne Hathaway does at least seem to be enjoying herself and trying to get other people to enjoy themselves. And you almost wish that the film had sort of paused for half an hour so Anne Hathaway could do a sort of rallying cry among the rest of the cast and go, come on, guys, or girls,
whatever. We only get one shot at this.
Yeah. Yeah, this the heist to actually try and steal some fun from somewhere, which sadly fell utterly flat.
The bit I enjoyed was the most was the very beginning, where Debbie Ocean has come out of prison and she has this confident, audacious manner of shoplifting and acquiring all the things she needs to get a start in the world. And with Ocean's 11, a lot of it was that. I mean, you said it was like attractive people going around in fabulous clothes doing a heist. And these women were often forced to be ditzy or incompetent, or to move the plot along they have to pretend to be lost, and this is not the confident aspirational swagger.
Is that, I had a problem with that Debbie Ocean's original, I mean, again, it was fun to watch because Sandra Bullock's fun to watch, but I couldn't get around this time. It didn't bother me so much with the George Clooney films, but perhaps it just felt like I just couldn't get around the fact that she was stealing from people who didn't deserve to be stolen from, in the whole scenes where she's getting hotel rooms she hasn't purchased and clothes she hasn't bought. She has to, when she gets perfume in one scene, at the very first scene, she walks into a department store and has a ruse to get free perfume. Well, that's a shop assistant that's probably going to be fired. I know you can't always take that sort of anger with you into these films, but this film never made her an attractive enough character. I don't feel...
But if the film had done something with it, because it would distinguish her from George Clooney's character in the original, it would be something to make this a worthwhile undertaking, other than the fact you've populated it with women. That shouldn't be the sole marketing point. You should actually have some differentiation between that and the original. And if that's...
Well, I think that is a differentiation. And I think that's a problem with how it depicts the women in the film, is that they aspire to an idea of feminine beauty that films give them. They want to be part of the 1%. They're not angry at anything. She comes out of prison after 5 years and she goes to get a really expensive perfume and a really expensive fur stole or whatever. I don't entirely believe that. And if I do believe it, I'm just angry at it, because why do you want these things? Why do you want to be in part? I didn't get that from Danny Ocean. I don't want to keep comparing these films, because that's a little bit unfair and it feels like a gender issue, but I don't feel this film really has written women for these roles. It's and I think that's a huge problem. They want to be part of the parade, the catwalk parade. They want to be part of that, and that bugged me.
Yeah, I didn't really get that feeling from them. The bit at the beginning, if you want to be a successful con artist, you've got to look the part, so you can't just come out of prison with no makeup and pull off heists.
That's true.
The women, they all had their own different reasons. I mean, they spoke about it, all the things that they wanted to do with the money at the end, and one person only wanted a Metro card. They have lower...
Well, that's halfway through, and that's a character who then becomes a sort of internet billionaire by the end of the film. I don't think it's a spoiler alert to tell the audience that the heist works. Is another problem,
Or does it?
Yes, this is true. Is another problem, perhaps, is a lack of a villain. Richard Armitage is fine, but he's not even playing a villain. He's playing Sandra Bullock's personal villain. There's no Andy Garcia character in this. There's no anybody. They're not battling against anybody in particular, until tellingly the last 20 minutes when James Corden's insurance agent comes in.
But I think some of this again feels like a function of that'll do. Because, as I understand it, Richard Armitage was brought in because Damian Lewis dropped out at the last minute. And so there's not much for him to have to pick up. He's just there to be the object of Sandra Bullock's ire. And again, everything is just, that's good enough. You know, that'll make a scene. Right, time to move on. The whole thing just feels slapdash, to be honest.
And again, isn't this again a sort of reductive in the screenplay that our lead con artist, that Sandra Bullock, Debbie Ocean's bête noire, would be a rubbish boyfriend? Again, it just seems rather too simplistic. You can't, because you have Cate Blanchett and Sandra Bullock and all these wonderful actresses, and they all go on these press tours and they have to promote the film and they say all these wonderful, positive, empowering statements, and I don't think the film's really doing any of that. I know it just seems full of the usual lazy filling. Basically, what I'm trying to say is filling a film with lead women doesn't solve the problem of films that aren't about rich and capable female characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of it comes back to what you said, like the poor shop assistant at the start. That's very much kind of every comedic foil that the lady con artists are playing against. All are just people trying to do the best job they can that are going to be horribly hard done by if they if the ladies succeed in their mission. It's just kind of a hackneyed get revenge angle from Sandra Bullock, against her boyfriend. But you never get a sense of, like, the original films, obviously set in Las Vegas, which is known for being sleazy and kind of having
Can be a villain there.
They're using that system against itself. They're kind of using the fact that, like in the original Soderbergh films, that men can just kind of like wander around in nice suits in Vegas and kind of immediately have the assumption that they're kind of on the up and up and doing well, and then they can slip by and like do kind of charismatic, like just use the kind of the sleazy criminal underbelly system to their benefit. There's nothing like that here. It's just kind of like a nice gala that they're trying to rob.
Let's not even mention the fact that there's no possible way this plan could have been gestated for 5 years in prison, because it's so dependent on both technology and specific events that are happening at this specific point in time. But again, the film just doesn't feel like it cares about that, and it's the fact that actually the original trilogy, even when they were at their worst, was trying something. In Ocean's 12, you get Bruce Willis and Julia Roberts popping up as Bruce Willis and Julia Roberts, and it's terrible, but at least it's trying to do something. The most this film feels like it's trying to do is to see if James Corden can act, and that's not trying hard enough. I'm sorry. We must do better.
I know he's not liked, but for some reason I don't quite know, but he made me laugh in this film a couple of times.
I have to say, he's one of the better things in it. I would put him probably in the top three things in it, and I think he's done very well for himself. I admire what he's done. I do actually watch lots of clips from his American chat show, but he does feel like he's Smithy from Gavin and Stacey. He doesn't act, he just wanders in and he's James Corden. And
but everybody's wandering in and being themselves, so perhaps that's what's in the...
He's doing that more than everyone else, and I think it's only the fact that he has some sense of likability that means that the film doesn't then just disappear down a black hole forever. Maybe it should have done.
Bridget, final point. Again, we the film raises makes a statement earlier on. Sandra Bullock's character says that this is a full all women crew because we need to be invisible and women aren't seen. It's the opposite of the male thing. But in the Ocean's 11 film, but this film does play. I say they want to rise themselves up to the 1%, but the half this of Mindy Kaling is all, and the pickpocket character, there's all characters that are Asian or Indian, and they end up playing servants, they end up playing the service industry, and the film doesn't seem to notice it's doing that, and doesn't seem to have any anger about that, any anger that the reason this heist can work is there's a whole section of American America that can pass for...
We don't get Rihanna's character saying, no, someone else do the janitor bit, I don't want to...
Exactly.
This is not where my talents lie. Yeah,
why do I have to do this?
Because I look like a janitor.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose the point I'm getting back to is this film, we need more films like this that are effortlessly filled with interesting female characters, but they need to be written better than this.
Yeah, how about letting some women write it and direct it next time?
Well, this was written by a woman.
it was co-written by a woman and by Gary Ross, and it very much had the feeling of Attack of the Clones, where George Lucas brought in somebody else to try and help him write dialogue, and it just didn't work. I think there are enough talented women in Hollywood and elsewhere that we can find a couple of good people to try and guide Ocean's 9, as inevitably will happen, through and actually give us an entertaining film.
All right, well, thank you very much. Ocean's 8 was released almost 2 weeks ago. Damn Monday film releases. But it's still showing at both View and Light cinemas, and it is a certificate 12A. Hollywood action films suggest that revenge can be uplifting, an almost cleansing act. But new German drama In the Fade, written and directed by Fatih Akin, shows that revenge is instead ugly, messy and shaky with grief. Diane Kruger won Best Actress at last year's Cannes Film Festival for her performance as Katya, who, along with her husband Nuri, is bringing up her young son in a Turkish quarter of Hamburg. Then both husband and son are killed in a bomb blast. Initially, the police look to pin the blame on Nuri's criminal past, but Katya suspects her husband's Turkish roots points towards a neo-Nazi terrorism link. As the case moves to the courts, it reveals assumptions and prejudices not just in the German legal system, but also in Katya's own family. Mark will skip a trailer, as it's understandably in German. In the Fade, it plays with genre conventions as a grief-stricken survivor for the first third of the film, then as a courtroom drama for the second third, and the third third is the revenge section of the film. Does it elevate any of those sort of generic components into anything more than a potboiler thriller, do you think?
I'm not sure it does. I did like the fact that it did try to pick those three components together, because I'm not sure I've seen that as almost a strict three-act structure in a film before. And it does feel like a natural journey for someone to go through in this kind of scenario. And it does all of the individual components well enough to a point. But the biggest flaw I found in this for me, it was just utterly predictable. I felt I knew how each of these three acts and these three stories was going to turn out at any given point. And while some of it is nicely shot, it never really surprised me, drew me into the tension, because often tension in films is drawn from that sense of unpredictability. And because we didn't have that unpredictability, because everything is going exactly the way you expect it, it never drew me in as much as it could have done.
Lorcan, that flies in the face of what you told me at the cinema on Thursday when I met you before I went in to see this film, is it didn't do what you were expecting.
Yeah, I think my reaction to the film was very much based on what I knew, what my limited knowledge was going into the film. The only thing I knew was that it was a revenge film featuring neo-Nazis. I'd read a piece by the filmmaker Fady Akin that he'd listened to lots of Queens of the Stone Age while writing the screenplay.
Joss Whedon does the music for this.
He introduced some of that music because he liked the kind of self-loathing atmosphere that it gave off. And so in my head, I was just dreading endless scenes of Diane Kruger opening countless leather cases filled with automatic weapons and walking into neo-Nazi bars. And I did find the first 40 minutes quite dry and dull, because it's just kind of, you very much know what, like Mark says, you very much know what's going to happen, and you know she has to kind of get over her grief and move on. But I wasn't expecting the middle third of the film to be a courtroom drama, which I found very engaging, and I started to find myself very engaged in where it was going. Again, there is a predictability element in the second act of the film, where you do kind of feel like things aren't going to go the way you want them to. But I still enjoyed the ride, and then for the last third of the film, it's very much, you don't know, I didn't know what Diane Kruger's character was ultimately going to do. The whole third act of the film is her struggling with herself and what decisions she's going to make, so I was very much with the film throughout.
Bridget, I can't remember if you'd seen this.
Yes, I have. The thing that I found that I like most about this was that it's a very affecting portrait of being an unsympathetic character, because she takes drugs and she's in a courtroom trying to get justice, and the way people try and discredit you, and to have to sit there in silence being calm while people say things about you is so terribly disempowering. I really felt for her, especially the way it was shot. There's a lot of very cold light, and she spends a lot of the first part of the film crying or in rain, so it's all sort of washed out, and she's got like these blue eyes which are also red eyes from the crying, and it just felt so cold.
I think there are certain things, following from what Bridget said, that do work for me in this. I think one of those is that sense of social commentary. It's how much people are being judged on their own morals, even if they are the victims in a crime rather than the perpetrators. You know, this morality we seem to have in 2018, and actually the film does give you quite a good sense of that as it goes through. Again, to a point, I think there are a few flaws in that, but by the by, I think it was heading in the right direction. The other thing I would commend is Diane Kruger's performance. I think I understand it's her first German film role, which surprised
German
me.
German language film role.
And I think she's a phenomenon in this. I would not have expected, based on her previous screen performances I've seen, that she had a performance like this in her. And all credit to her. I think she's the absolute star of this and holds it all together.
Quick point. It's the director has said he wanted only her viewpoint throughout the film, and that works brilliantly at the beginning because we don't see the explosion, we don't hear it in the distance. It goes a very untraditional route for the death of her family members, and it's all the more affecting for that, the fact that she has to first imagine it and then hear about it in court. But I was trying to work out, there was something all the way through from the second act onwards, I just felt like I was being manipulated, very cleverly, but manipulated nonetheless. And I think it all swung on the fact that she remembers the crime she remembers the pre-crime scene to the police, and she describes the woman who was outside her husband's business and who presumably dropped the bomb off. And unless I'm mistaken here, and you might want to correct me, it's the same woman we do see in court. So there's no ambiguity about her statement. So as she then goes down this road into becoming through grief, but still a suicide bomber, which is the interesting thing to do it. It's showing us a suicide bomber who's a white woman who's suffering a grief we understand, so therefore we're slightly more complacent about what she's turning into. We forgive her because there's no ambiguity in whether she saw what she saw. I have a real issue with that. That seems a major misstep to me, confirming to us that the bomber is the right person.
I feel like without that, though, we would lack a certain amount of tension during the whole middle kind of courtroom sequence where...
But we would wonder more about the drugs. The defense attorney, who's an unpleasant child catcher of a character, would be less needed. There would be probable cause. He wouldn't need to be such a stereotypically Hollywood villain.
I think for me, it's an attempt to try and get us to retain empathy for Diane Kruger's character whilst still understanding the fact that she has flaws. So I can kind of see why it was done, but I can also see your point that it may be a little bit conflicted in terms of what it's actually delivered.
I think it also helps, like, what does end up happening at the end will feel more justified, knowing that they definitely were the perpetrators as well.
Yeah, but we shouldn't feel that. We shouldn't feel, even in this day and age when every third person's a Nazi, we shouldn't feel that the end is just the means. The end is justified the means. We shouldn't do that.
I think Bridget's going to come in and say, just before that, I think there are some bigger moral questions the film could ask in terms of, again, it's talked about, you know, the sort of situation and, you know, judging people based on their own morals rather than being the moral of the victims. Ultimately, the big moral questions it sets up in terms of you know, personal justice and things like that, it doesn't really answer, ultimately. You know, the film does come to a conclusion, and a fairly rigid one without giving it away, but I feel that moral questioning gets lost at the end of the second act when we come out of the courtroom.
It's true. Bridget, did you have... Sorry,
I was just wondering of the three of us which one was the
I know, team. I yes, did realise as soon yes. as I'd said that. I thought I probably shouldn't have said that. And two, also one in three is not good mathematics when there's four people in the studio.
I'm the Christian who is a single white straight male, so I'm clearly the likely suspect. No, I'll take that for
this. This is not something I should have ever jested about.
Hashtag not a Nazi. Yeah,
okay. All right, anyway, onwards. Of all the sequels offered up this summer, a follow-up to Sicario is a bit of a surprise. The first film, directed by Denis Villeneuve, starred Emily Blunt as an FBI agent tumbling through the violent and immoral world of the drug wars on the US-Mexican border. The sequel, Sicario Soldado, which I think means soldier, no longer has Villeneuve or Blunt, but it does offer more violence and amorality. The movie opens with a bomb in Kansas City, the work of Islamic terrorists smuggled into the USA by a Mexican cartel. This terror connection allows the CIA to militarize their war on drugs, and once again they look to Graver, a blunt weapon special agent played by Josh Brolin, to kick up a fuss on the border. Graver plans to kidnap the daughter of a powerful drug lord and kickstart a war between the rival gangs.
Your objective is to start a war between the Mexican cartels. Not with the Mexican government.
This girl was witness to the mission, correct?
Yes, sir.
We can't risk her falling into the wrong hands. Clean the scene.
They want me to cut ties. You gotta get rid of her.
I can't do that.
Don't put me in that situation.
You gotta do what you gotta do.
I'm gonna need a strike team to Blackhawks. Drones with attack capability.
Where's the coup?
Mexico.
Bridget, the first Sicario, which came out in 2015, it was an autumn release at the cinema. It was a somber and serious film with a political undercurrent. Sicario 2 is a summer release with lots of guns on the posters. Is it fair to suggest it has a more bombastic approach to its story?
Oh, yes. I was quite disappointed by this film. I loved the first movie. I watched it twice. The first time I watched it, I thought it was a story about Emily Blunt's character. And as you follow her through, I got quite disappointed with the way she'd been treated. And then the second time I watched it, I realised it's not really about her. It's about Matt Graver and Alejandro Gillick, who are the
Benicio del Toro
yeah. characters, and their novel approach to justice and law-bringing. But they had such depth in that film, and the first one, we open with this a fairly cheap house, and there's a whole load of police officers, ordinary people going around trying to find out, and then sort of low-key horribleness happens, whereas this film opens with helicopters. So, you know, straight away, this film's got a big budget. It's just going to throw helicopters at you.
It's going to, yeah, it's going to take, it seems to have taken the wrong lessons from the first film, perhaps. And
it's kept all of those lovely noises, and you get lots of people in silhouette against the sunset, which looks beautiful.
Is this what worked the first time round? Yes. This is what audiences want, more silhouettes.
But
I mean, I found it a bit odd in the sense that from Taylor Sheridan, we had Sicario, which worked because it had subtlety.
This is the writer, Taylor Sheridan.
Taylor Sheridan is the writer. So he wrote Sicario. He also then wrote Hell or High Water and wrote and directed Wind River with Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen. And all three of those films, whether or not you like them, I would hope you would agree, they deliver in spades on character. They drive their plots forward by character development and motivation. And it seems odd that maybe it's an experiment on Taylor's part that he's trying to see if he can drive a plot forward by taking away everyone's character and just making them blank canvas, which is slightly disappointing when it's a sequel and when those people had interesting characters and motivations set up in the first place.
I was so struck by when we first met Josh Brolin's character in this second film and how different it was. He's a lot more sort of nihilistic. I thought, what traumatic event has happened between the first film and this one that we're going to find out about that's affected him so much? And apparently nothing. He's just lost all of his depth, all of his subtlety, all of his cleverness.
Somehow we've ended up with Josh Brolin playing the least interesting character of the three that he's played this summer, and when the other two are Thanos and Cable, that's a bit of a worry because, you know, based on the first film, that shouldn't have been the case.
He's more like a bad Kurt Russell meathead character.
Are we losing something more with the Emily Blunt character? Not just obviously having a female lead in a film like this, but also having a contrast. Is there anybody to point? A film like this doesn't necessarily need a character to point out you're amoral, you've gone too far. And again, that could be quite a cliche, tiresome cliche as well. But without that, is especially with a film that's dealing with the subject matter of Mexico and borders, is that an issue? Is there anybody to replace Blunt's idealism?
I think we lose that, and I think we lose that in so many other ways as well, because the original film was able to reflect different perspectives on all sides of the conflict. I think the biggest frustration for me is Isabella Moner's character. She plays the young girl who's kidnapped, which is the focus for the plot. And the first time we see her, she is in a school and she's dominating the headmaster. She's telling him that, you know, because of who she is, she cannot be constrained in any way. She's bursting with confidence and cockiness, and she looks like she's going to be a brilliant character. And from that point on, she is 50% woman tied to the train tracks in a black and white film and 50% female character that enables the male characters to learn more about themselves. And it's a complete and utter waste.
Is there also... What really, really bugs me here is, again, you can make films about the Mexican border. Now is not an ideal time, but the film would have been started 2 years ago. It wouldn't have been quite the situation we are in now. But this film begins with a terrorist attack, an Islamic terrorist attack, that is fantastical. I know we've had 9/11, but we've had nothing on the scale that this film presents. This film opens with what middle America Trump voters fear will happen if they allow anybody non-white into the country. I find that very questionable.
The film does at certain points make reference to actually what's driving these bombardier characters at the beginning about the sort of machinations of that, but whereas the first film would have felt interested in understanding how that affected the bigger picture, this just feels like dressing that the film is keen to get past and show more men wandering around the desert with guns. And there was a moment, actually, when they're having a conversation, Catherine Keener and Josh Brolin are talking, and she says that POTUS has made this decision. And it actually took me out of the film for a moment because I was thinking, Are we talking about a fake president, the current president, a previous president? I was then trying to play through in my head the moral implications of that decision in the context of current and historical political frameworks, and no point for the next few minutes got to get it to make any sense in that context. And it feels like either you set up that world completely so you can play in your own sandbox, or you embrace the current realities of the political nature. And let's be honest, we've lived in this political world for at least 2 years. That is time for this film to have adjusted if it needed to. And it just didn't feel like it had a grasp on that or what it wanted to do with it.
It could have just put a news clipping in with somebody watching in the background with POTUS making a speech to set it...
Yeah, that could have been easily covered off, and it just didn't feel like it had an understanding of what it wanted to do. There's the sort of cut-off line of Matthew Modine's character, who's as high as you interact with in the political world, and everything beyond that just feels like it's trying to have its own world, and then it tries to have a little bit more of the wider world, but doesn't make any sense in doing it, and it took me out of the film.
Is there a pretentiousness to a film that is basically just, and there's nothing wrong with this, a B-movie Western, pretending it has... coasting off the ideals and smartness of the first film and pretending it's something more, pretending it's sort of the great American novel when really it's a tatty paperback you'd find in your jacket pocket.
I mean, I'm not going to say it's completely without merit, because there were certain things I enjoyed, and I feel it's actually, by the end of it, built a more interesting world for a third film to come and play in. But it's just a shame that we had to have the second film to do that. And I think there is talk of even trying to bring back Emily Blunt's character for the third film, which to me feels slightly pointless because I think her story's done, without wishing to spoil the first film. But, you know, I would watch a third of these films. I would hope it's more of the quality of the first than the second.
OK, all right. Well, Sicario 2 opened yesterday and is now showing at both the Light and View cinemas, and it is a Certificate 15.
Cambridge has a vibrant food and drink scene. On Flavour, we talk with a wide range of food and drink producers. We visit cafes, restaurants, pubs and independent food stores. We find out what's new and what's good. We review the food items in the papers. If it's about food and drink, if it's local and good, it's on Flavour. Alternate Saturdays, 12 till 1, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Still to come on Bums on Seats, we have the American tale of Leave No Trace, but first, we're Exile in Paris.
For 2 years, I have lain on hardwoods, knelt on cold stone, dined on shame. I am ready to return to life.
I feel sure that if I was to see him once, I would forgive him everything.
I can make you happy.
Yes, you can. I dare say what I have done is fatal.
Be careful, Roscoe.
I love him as I always did, with a sense of tragedy and ruin. There's no mystery so great as suffering. But suffering is nothing when there is love. Love is everything.
The Triumph and Tragedy of Oscar Wilde has been dramatised for cinema a fair few times, but The Happy Prince, which was released last week, is the first film to focus entirely on the writer's unhappy life after his prison sentence. It's a labour of love for Rupert Everett, who not only stars as Wilde, but also wrote the script and makes his directorial debut. His film isn't quite the traditional biopic either. Rather, it's more of a collage of Wilde's later life. We do see his brutal experience in prison, but that's intercut with his release and self-imposed exile in France, where he lives under a pseudonym, survives on charity, and rekindles his affair with Bosie Douglas. This brief happy holiday is then contrasted with Wilde's final months in Paris, the great playwright destitute and his only audience the appreciative drunks in a seedy bar. Mark, coming back to you, the life of Oscar Wilde should be manna for the British film industry, all those vistas and hats and prejudice, but does The Happy Prince being such a personal project for Rupert Everett, does that sidestep some of the usual issues of well-meaning British prestige pictures?
I think there are a few, and you certainly get dragged into those by some of the casting. It's impossible not to feel like you're in a prestige British pick when Colin Firth and Emily Watson and people rock up.
First scene of Emily Watson, the first shot of her on her canes, it was like, oh dear, and Colin Firth playing a character almost 30 years younger than he really is.
Yeah, and having popped up with another of the fantastic moustaches of our time from the same box Kenneth Branagh seemingly used for Murder on the Orient Express, I wish I could get access to that moustache box.
Box in Pinewood Studios.
I would be all over it. I will say, I think eventually this film actually sort of won me over by its process. I struggled with it in maybe the first 30 minutes or so because of that fractured structure, because it's hopping all over the place with not really any seemingly clear intention of where it's going and why. I always have an issue with flashbacks in films, in particular if you get a film that has this, it's not in media res, but something like that, where you have a scene at the beginning that's sort of cut out, and then you flash back in time and then eventually reach that scene, and then you realise there was no reason to give you that information earlier on. This doesn't do that, but it does have an unstructured narrative, and it wasn't clear to me up front why it's doing that, and that eventually took me out of the film, but eventually that collage sort of washed over me and did actually win me back in, and ultimately gave me a sense of the spirit that was shining through in those last days of Oscar Wilde's life.
Lorcan, this is a low budget film, and that shows, but I think it shows in a way that again helps the film. There's a staginess to it. There's a closeness to the shots in order to obviously not show that the sets don't expand that wide. And Rupert Everett was going for a sort of dreamlike feel, and I don't think he's been entirely successful, but I think this comes quite near. And again, I'd rather have this than cut to a wide shot of a manor house in Bath and a carriage goes by, like that French and Saunders sketch, and we're in that world. I much prefer this sort of dingy, slightly unpleasant world.
Well, it helps build a sense of realism. I think it's great to see a film by someone so clearly passionate about its subject matter, and I think Rupert Everett did a pretty good job writing, especially for his first directing gig. I think he did a really good job, and his performance is great. I think it tries to do a lot of things correctly. And presumably it is, like, I assume Rupert Everett did a lot of research. I assume it's full of, like, tons of interesting
facts. He spent many,
many
years prepping this, yes.
Yeah. And I'm sure it is full of lots of nice things. I think the editing, the way the film's structured and the editing is really interesting. I think it's reminiscent of, what was that, Harmony Korine film, Spring Breakers, where it's kind of like using odd editing to get a sense of fun and adventure, but simultaneously giving you like the kind of disturbing underbelly and the disturbing underside.
It's both
of
the
that.
Party and the hangover at the same time, isn't it? Yeah.
But I think he does do a really good job of this overall achievement of making a sympathetic performance to potentially a somewhat dubious character. But it doesn't leave much of a lasting impression. There's something about it that's just kind of lacking. I feel like they may have missed a trick in that. In the current kind of political climate, doing a story about separating the art from the artist, and if you start to view a certain artist as a morally reprehensible character, as many characters in this film do, can you still appreciate the art, or do you have to kind of revile them and kind of exile them? And the film does kind of lightly touch on that kind of thing. I would have liked to see a bit more of that kind of philosophy and kind of playing around with that idea. But overall, I think the film was pretty fine, but I'm not, like I say, it hasn't left much of a lasting impression on me.
Bridget, do you think it? Because it doesn't soft so it doesn't it doesn't try to make Wilde more attractive than he was. Obviously, he's a great man, a great writer, but it does portray him warts and all.
Yes, it's a good way of looking at the vileness in civility. There are all of these very well-bred people who are very clever and really quite mean and horrible. And a lot of that, it was reminding me of films like It or A Clockwork Orange, where you've got these posh people quite barbaric.
Yeah. There's the scene where they're chased through the French coastal village they're staying in, through the streets by the what would be the Bullington Club sort of people, really, which I thought was actually surprising, because you don't see a scene with characters like that, bullies like that, as you say, Clockwork Orange type characters like that in a British period film very often. Sorry, carry on.
No, and also I was again, like Mark, a bit thrown by the fractured narrative, but there's a way of looking at the dramatisation, the dramatic segments. It's Ian Wilde was a great raconteur, so if you imagine this is him telling his anecdotes to his admiring audience so well, you can actually feel the rain at Clapham Junction Station.
But even the first scene in the film, which is him telling his tale of the Little Prince to his own children, so it's a flashback within a flashback, but it begins with, "This is a dream." So that's the first words to the audience. But I think that works too. I think there's too many links here. There's a link between a song he sings in the bar in Paris, which links to the music hall, and then there's another link with another melody. There's too many little links here. And the weird thing is, which I quite admire because it's so wrong-headed, is actually the film ends with Robbie Ross's character. He's one of his many, I don't think he was ever a boyfriend, but one of his many partners. It ends with him, and ends with him striding away while Bosie shouts at him. It doesn't end on anything a Wild, which is just so off balance that I can't. It endeared itself to me. Because again, if this had been directed by almost anybody else, it would have been so predictable. I think that's this film's saving grace. If it had been directed, I'm not going to name names, but I can think of 1,000 British directors who would have made this. And the homosexuality in it would have been coyer as well.
I think Rupert Everett has actually managed to tease out some interesting performances. The highlight for me was probably Colin Morgan playing Bosie. He actually felt like a genuinely vile character that you wanted to see more of. Always that delicate balance that you get on screen. But I think it was those kind of things which Bridget touched on in terms of, you know, the kind of people that you see on the screen. And I think that was a prime example of where the film was at its best in pulling out that murky character that actually you were compelled to watch.
OK, well, The Happy Prince opened last week and is still showing at both the Arts Picture House and the Light Multiplex. It's a Certificate 15, and it is, I think it's worth seeing. I think I just want to reward Rupert Everett for trying so long to make this film. Anyway, it could have been The Danish Girl, that's what it could have been. Anyway,
hopefully it was.
Sorry. We wrap up the show on the edge of the modern American wilderness, the setting for Leave No Trace, the much-anticipated return of director Deborah Granik. Like Granik's last fiction film, The Excellent Winter's Bone, which was released all the way back in 2010, Leave No Trace is a story from the fringes of US life. Ben Foster plays Will, an army veteran who has opted for a quiet, low-impact life off the grid. With Tommy's 13-year-old daughter, he lives an invisible life in a dense forest on the edge of a vast public park. He sleeps in a tent, they hunt for their own food, and they survive on the little money Will gets for selling his opioid medication. But then Will makes a mistake of being spotted. Social services sweep in and scoop both into the hands of the authorities.
It's not a crime to be unhoused, but it's illegal to live on public land.
We have found an option.
Are we gonna be okay here?
You can still think our own thoughts.
Keep pedaling. Look where you want to go.
School is about social skills, not just intellectual ones.
I think it might be easier on us if we try to attack.
We're wearing their clothes, we're in their house, we're eating their food, we're doing their work. We have adapted. First of a thousand,
right on the wall.
Pack your things.
Did he even try? Because I can't tell. I don't want to leave. Same thing that's wrong with you isn't wrong with me.
Where are you guys headed?
I don't think we knew where we were going.
Bridget, Winter's Bone, 8 years ago, that demonstrated Deborah Cranick's quality of empathy when depicting outsider figures that cinema, most mass media, ignores. Is this something Leave No Trace also demonstrates, this empathy?
Yes, I didn't know anything about it going in other than it was Deborah Granik's new film after Winter's Bone, and I really enjoyed watching these characters' journeys unfold. It's a very tense film. There's a lot of characters come into their life, like this person, and what is this organisation, and when are they going to get punished for this or that? But they go through a lot of different communities and different groups of people. So it's also a study of a whole load of ways to live at the edges of society. And when you look at that, you can sort of decide more what society is, how you define society by looking at what's happening on the edges of it. And she's Yeah.
Mark, does it fall into... Because a couple of years ago, everybody sort of raved. I have no idea why. It was like the world had gone mad. They raved about Captain Fantastic, which also had an outsider figure, somebody who'd chosen to raise his children in off the grid. That was sentimental as all heck. Does this film... I've prejudiced your argument here. Is this film making a similar mistake? Is this, as Bridget pointed out, there's a reality of community here, a reality of the characters.
There absolutely is, and I will join the band of people who thought Captain Fantastic was an utter waste of everyone's time. It was just a bunch of caricatures acting in ways that no human being ever would, and just made me want to claw at the screen. And this had the opposite effect. This made me want to go and hug Ben Foster and his daughter, whose name I've shamelessly forgotten. I'm sure at some point while I'm talking, Toby's going to put this up on a screen so I can see. Tom is the character's name, and I can remember weirdly the fact she was in Shortland Street, the New Zealand soap opera. But I can't remember her actual name because I'm terrible with names.
Thomason Mackenzie?
I'm going to take that and run with it. Anyway, her name is not important. The fact she's a brilliant actress and the two of them in combination... Thomason Mackenzie, yep. The fact that the two of them in combination are so believable that if you'd told me she was genuinely Ben Foster's daughter in real life when we were watching a documentary, I'd have bought that. They are just such an incredibly compelling on-screen pairing. But then... everyone around them feels so naturalistic, almost as if these two just wandered into a documentary, and the whole thing just has this human quality to it that makes you root for their characters. It's also, and I'm not enough an expert in this to know, but it just seems edited so tightly. It struck me at the end of the film, sorry, I'm rambling a bit here, you'll shut me up if I've talked too much. There is a scene at the end of the film where you see a standard cobweb in a tree, as well, they're walking through the woods, and it's the first time after an hour and 40 minutes you see a shot like that in the film. The film is so good at moving itself along, never hesitating longer than it needs to on a scene, and keeping you in the characters and keeping you in the tension of the scene, and only when it just needs to get a slight release at the end does it actually resort to that kind of cliche, but never before it.
Lorcan Deborah Cranick doesn't have a background in documentary. She's made a documentary between Winter's Bone and this about Vietnam vets, Army vets, which is where she gets the empathy for Ben Foster's character. But she has a background in corporate filmmaking and industry filmmaking, like Robert Altman did, actually. Is that a benefit here? Is it that documentary style closeness to her characters and understanding and, again, an empathy?
Just to throw some more shade on Captain Fantastic.
I'm sorry.
Just could not stand the film.
Please do.
I really love the performances here, and something that this film does very well that ties into what you were saying about the kind of more corporate filmmaking or the documentary filmmaking, yeah. Is that here it successfully portrays or implies how forceful, patronizing, and sometimes invasive modern society can get. And you really feel for Ben Foster's character and his daughter when they're kind of forced into the situation that they accept exists, they don't hate, but they just don't want to take part in it. And I particularly loved the use of kind of the visual use of nature in unnatural circumstances, particularly in the social services center. There's lots of kind of those cheesy motivational posters that are like challenged, and it's a field of a beautiful wheat field, or like there's lots of like posters of forests, and like there's like leaves painted on banisters, all while they're telling Ben Foster and his daughter that they're not allowed to live by their own means in a public park. I love that contrast, and just in general the fully fleshed out and imperfect yet sympathetic father played by Ben Foster, really kind of and the chemistry he has with the familial chemistry he has with the daughter really plays well and just sucks you in. I wasn't the biggest fan of Winter's Bone. I found this film much more cohesive and efficient narrative-wise. And like Mark says, the editing and the narrative is quite tight and everything feels like it's in the right place for the right reasons.
Does it demonize the social services? Because that's been a sort of a lazy fallback on films in the last 10 years, that anybody who comes to take your children away is bad. Also, because you haven't offered any depth of why that happens?
I don't think it is. I mean, we're primed to fall into thinking of these people as threats who are going to try and separate the family and make them do things they don't want to do. But as you go through the film and all the people they interact with, you gradually realise that there aren't any external antagonists. No one wants to make bad things happen to this father and daughter.
In fact, some of the tension arises because the social services are doing exactly the right thing for them, and yet Ben Foster's character shuns that because he still can't cope. He's in this PTSD bubble that he can't escape from despite everyone's best intentions. And it's actually, in that sense, the goodwill. There is one scene that's a little bit the way that you described, where he goes back to visit another group of veterans that are also in tents in the woods, and their settlement is being torn down because they were exposed, because Ben Foster and Thomas McKenzie were exposed. And so that is a little bit of the cliche of you know, tearing things down with a JCB, but that probably is the only moment when that happens. The rest is a genuine human struggle, and it's a film full of empathy.
Okay, all right. Well, I know, Bridget, you said you might end up one of your films of the year, so...
Yes.
Yes. It's
certainly comfortably my film of the week, let's say that.
Oh, yeah. All right, well, Leave No Trace opened yesterday. It is now screening at the Arts Picture House, and it is a certificate PG. That is all we have time for on today's show. As ever, the past hour will be repeated tomorrow at 2 p.m. Then our podcast will be released on Monday. That can either be downloaded or streamed from our page on the Cambridge 105 website. Also there, you'll find links to editions of the show which stretch back the last few years. We're also to be found on iTunes, where, of course, you can subscribe to the show and leave a review. I don't know what it gets us, but everybody's after reviews. We'll be back in a fortnight's time on July the 14th. That show should have reviews of Mary Shelley, a drama based around the personal life of the great writer. Sounds a little reductive, but it is directed by the Saudi Arabian filmmaker who made the wonderful Wajah, so... hopes. Plus, we should have the first look at First Reformed, which marks the return of Paul Schrader. I'm very much looking forward to that. Then there's Skyscraper, with Dwayne Johnson as the safety expert having to battle criminals atop the world's tallest building. And there's Incredibles 2, which has had excellent reviews from its American release, which is perhaps slightly tarnished by the reveal the studio isn't the most progressive place in Hollywood. That's disappointing. Anyway, please stay tuned for 21st Century Women, or if you're listening to our repeat, please stay tuned for highlights from last year's Cambridge Folk Festival. From everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye. Bye.